Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Welcome back to Tennis Unfiltered with me, James Gray of iNews.co.uk and the iNewspaper, where technical difficulties are our favourite thing. George Belshaw's with me. Calvin Betton's going in and out of shot, but I can only assume he's going to hang around long enough to give us his much sought-after opinions. I'm going to dip straight into the mailbag this week before even telling you what's going to go on, because we've had lots of things in and lots of reaction to last week's episode, so I wanted to bring up as much of it as possible. First of all, a review. Remember, if you enjoy the podcast, we really appreciate it when you leave us a five-star review, and I will always read them out on the podcast if I get a chance. This one's from Seagull68, which might mean you're on the South Coast, perhaps. I'm not sure. Tennis hotbed as it is. It says, certainly the best podcast around about tennis, considered constructive opinions, and those of the listeners also shown respect, regardless of whether the hosts agree with them. This is probably because this podcast doesn't appear to be recorded in an echo chamber, unlike some. Slightly unfair and snide giveaway at the end, but thanks, Seagull, very much for your review, and we always appreciate them. Right, into the mailbag. Let's start with one that's simply addressed Calvin. It's from Philip, who is a regular correspondent from out in Las Vegas, a fan and a friend of the pod. I attended the Netflix Slam, and there were a couple of events before the main match, which it seems you did not get on TV. Doubles match between the Bryan brothers, Jeannie Bouchard and Aisha Mohammed. And an ace challenge between Querrey, Isner, Fritz and Tiafo. The ace challenge was so bizarre you would have been entertained, Kelvin. There were three rounds with each player serving for 90 seconds and the slowest each round dropped out. So Francis Tiafo served 8 balls in 90 seconds in round one. That was it. Even if Rafa got $1 million, I'm sure Tiafo got a higher rate per minute. The live experience was good, except they were very slow letting people in. Was it worth $300? Well, my wife spent the same on kids' musical Blippi, so on a relative basis, I have to say yes. In reality, though, no. Like everything in Las Vegas, overpriced and underwhelming, or at least that's what people tell me, I suppose.
What's Blippi?
Yeah, pass. George, I don't have children, and when my nephews and nieces are watching things on TV, I try and zone it out. It explains and explores exciting things like fire trucks, zoos, animals, garbage trucks, space and tractors, while teaching children about numbers, colours, shapes, words and more. I mean, I basically get on board with that. He's probably a multi-millionaire, but I've never heard of him. So, thanks, Philip, for your email, and good to hear what it was like live as well. I don't know how much it's all going to catch on, but we'll see. Right, one from Lynn. It says, thanks for another entertaining pod. My tennis has 2 Astro, 2 hard and 3 grass courts. There's always a rush to book the Astro, especially in winter. And in fact, the club are hoping to change the 2 hard courts to Astro at some point. I play on average 5 times a week. Without the Astro, I'd hardly play at all in the winter. So it's a big vote from me. P.S. What makes Calvin happy in life?
We're still trying to work that one out, aren't we?
Go on then, Calvin. What makes you? You're wearing a Ramones t-shirt.
Listening to the Ramones or a lot of bands.
Well, you're trainers. Off to. You said you're coming back to the UK for a day next month, or later this month, to go and see.
I'm going to see Liam Gallagher and John Squire.
I was about to say David Squires, and then realised that's the Guardian cartoonist. Or what?
Yeah, I'm not going to see him performing with Liam Gallagher, George. No.
I would pay money. I'm sure yes, that would be entertaining.
That would be weird. Winning tennis matches. That's my players winning tennis matches. That makes me happy for about a minute before I start thinking about the next one.
Okay, it's good to know that some of these things do exist. Right, I've got a couple more from the mailbag, if I can go and find it. This is a good one, Calvin. You're going to have thoughts on this, I know. Hi, all. This is from Laurie. I'm just wondering if you guys could shed any light on why Bisham Abbey stopped being the national tennis centre in the UK. When I hear all the Bisham boys, Simon Dixon, Dan Kiernan, and Martin Lee, etc., talk about their time there, they always say it was an amazing time. Not only this, but the coach Ian Barkley seemed to get great results in producing top juniors. I believe Simon Dixon had brilliant results as a junior, and Martin Lee was world junior number one. When the players' experience was so positive and tennis seemed to be going so well, what precipitated the change? Calvin, I know there's names in there you know very well.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, I think a lot of the players really liked it because there was quite a social scene as well around there. It's not far from, I think, Marlow is the town near there. And I know a few of my best friends went to Bisham Abbey around that time, and I know they enjoyed life outside of tennis, shall we say. Also had a golf course on there, and most of them were golfers, and there was a lot of golf going on. But I do think it was a good, you know, I mean, it's 25, 30 years ago now that those guys were there. But, you know, it did produce some good players. The reason why it stopped, I think, was, again, as with everything, it was finance. I think that Bisham Abbey is its own company, or it was at the time. I think it still is. And I think they had a contract with the LTA to host their, you know, National Academy there. And I think the contract was just up and they couldn't agree a deal to do it again. And I think that they then went to Queen's Club for a while, where the National Centre was unofficially based. And they had all the same players who were at Bisham would train there. And then after that, they built while that was still happening, they built the National Tennis Centre.
There you go. I hope that answers questions in some way. I mean, yeah, when you look at the Bisham Abbey National Sports Centre website, it's very slick. It's very high-end. I imagine it was pretty expensive for the LTA. Marlow, yeah. I believe, is Simon Briggs' country, isn't it? So maybe we'll take a little pod trip up there. Not that he's been on for a long time, but maybe if we agree to go to Marlow, then he'd actually come on again.
Sure, we could arrange a doubles match as well at a time.
Yeah, there you go. I can umpire. Yeah,
it's actually, I think, apparently, because Bisham Abbey continued to house tennis academies after the tennis had left there. There was a company called Wind Tennis that ran quite a big academy out there. They had a lot of players. But I think Marlow is quite an affluent area, and it was often said that they always had basically a stream of tennis players who, if they wanted to play tennis, they definitely wouldn't have any issue paying for trips abroad and that kind of thing, as some academies tend to hit. So, yeah.
There you go. And finally, I'm just going to follow up on our conversation about Red Plus courts last week, which sparked lots of conversation. Red Plus themselves have been in touch, or at least the UK suppliers, offering to put up their CEO for a chat about it on the podcast. So that's something we might set up a little bit later on. They were very pleased, needless to say, that we'd bother to talk about it. Matthew from Little Aston is just following up to say we lose some days to heavy rain and thawing frost, but no more than a few weeks. The court structure sounds similar to what Calvin described in Greece. The surface does a good job of negating the British weather and plays close to real clay, or close enough to have attracted some up-and-coming players to practice at the club, including Mimi Zhu, Rana Stoiber, Felix Gill and Henry Searle. They require a lot less maintenance than real clay, but do render some maintenance nonetheless.
I saw Jay Clark having a hit there last year with Arnie, who's the coach that Matthew mentioned before as well. So,
yeah. And they've got them at Sutton Coldfield as well, where Dan Evans is not a regular hitter, but has certainly been seen recently hitting there.
Sutton hard courts. That's where I started my career, James. How funny. We're linking all my career, meaning when I was six.
and on that note, George, Matthew very kindly notes, the clay courts will be very good for George's knees, according to our more senior members. He's welcome to give them a try.
I'll have to link up with Arnie and come and check them out.
Yeah, exactly. Right, one more comes all the way from Australia, in Melbourne, where he says it's 37 degrees all weekend. Quite jealous at the moment, to be honest. Thanks for all the great podcasts in recent weeks. Who do you think will end up being the more disruptive tennis parent and end up ruining their child's career most? The choices are Runa's mother, Tsitsipas's father. I have left out Raducanu's father from this list for now. This might be niche, but after following the game for 44 years, isn't there a tennis book waiting to be written on disruptive tennis parents? Maybe even a movie. Keep up the great chat. Calvin's insights are particularly good. I almost didn't read that bit, but anyway. Yeah, Runa's mother or Tsitsipas's father.
I mean, why is Tsitsipas's mum got a pass on this?
Yeah,
they're a double act. She doesn't sit in the coaching box that often.
She sits in the press conference, apparently, doesn't she?
Yeah, yeah, her interventions are definitely noteworthy when they do come.
It was actually interesting that I don't know whether you guys saw it this week, but Jennifer Capriati put a tweet out about, I think maybe on some American TV, they'd commented on like bad tennis parents. Mm. And I think Lindsay Davenport had mentioned Capriati's dad, and she came strongly to his defence and said that he was not to be compared with any of the other people who she mentioned, that he was keen, basically a very keen tennis parent, but he never, you know, never went into violence or abuse and that kind of thing. I don't know. I don't really remember the story behind it. Obviously, she was a very young player, was Capriati. I don't know whether that, you know, was true or not. But it seemed like she was very upset about the suggestion that her dad had been included in a group with Djokic and somebody else.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. Just to give her the full quote, I can't believe what I just heard being said about my father. I can't let my father's memory be slandered any longer. My father was the most loving, kind, supportive, beautiful father and daughter could ask for. He was adored and loved by everyone. So there you go. Lindsay Davenport.
Not to the extent of Djokic, etc. But there is a bloody fine line, isn't there, in tennis parenting as a whole. Like, I do think, you know, you do probably need quite pushy parents to make it in tennis. Like, that is a bit of a given. Like, you'd need someone who's willing to drive you around and let you hit thousands of tennis balls a day. Like, you won't make it otherwise. So I think, you know, I it's obviously very different experiences, but there were lots of parents like that at clubs who did want their kids to be professional players, and you knew who they were around the club. You get them at every club, whether the kid's going to make it or not. And everyone would describe them as pushy, but they're probably not that different to kind of what the pros need to be. And obviously, the line when you start in that sort of territory is quite easy to cross, to be honest, when, you know, you're essentially forcing your dream on your child, to be honest, because otherwise how else is a six-year-old going to have the drive to do it? You know, that line is very easy to become blurred, and that's not defending the parents, but I think there's, you know, is such a fine line to tread in that sphere.
It's interesting because a friend of mine who used to play tennis, a very good tennis player, and he kind of like has a bit of a gripe with the LTA in general, or inverted commas, the LTA, as I keep saying. I don't know what people refer to when they talk about the LTA. But he sent me a video yesterday about a quite interesting one about early specialisation in sport. Basically, kids only playing one sport from a young age. And the video was saying how it's counterproductive and we need to get as many as possible. And he was saying that, you know, we fall so short on this, the LTA falls short on this. And I was like, no, come on. I was like, the LTA have encouraged multi-sport for some time at a young age, but the decision will ultimately rest with the parents. And there is too much early specialisation in tennis and in other sports, I think, as well. But that tends to come down to the parents have an idea of what sport they want their kids to play to an elite level, and trying to tell them that it might be better for their tennis, golf, football or whatever, if they spend an almost equal amount of time playing other sports, they just think you're crazy and it's wasted time not being able to do that. So that's the kind of thing that plays in with tennis parents. You know, like George said, you do need to, it's a mad life, it's a crazy life, so you need to be a little bit crazy to take it on. But at the same time, the decision making from parents is not often great.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's a great book, funny enough, Ian, on that sort of note, to be written about raising a champion, and tennis is the kind of, it's so full of stories, good and bad, and like I think I said this at the time, but you know, the King Richard film about Richard Williams, I still think is quite a big whitewash and portrays him as a hero, and I don't think he is entirely a hero. I think we said, I think, sure, I remember you saying something similar, Calvin, he he is one way to raise champions, but I don't necessarily think that he should be the textbook. And yet, I mean, I'm trying to think. Someone even said it recently that they had pretty much idolised Richard Williams and gone, this is how I'm going to raise... I wish I could remember who it was. Ah, I know who it was. It was in Ben Rothenberg's book about Naomi Osaka and how her father had pretty much, you know, read about that story and gone, that's how I want to do this. And, well, we could get ourselves into some trouble talking a bit more about that, but I haven't finished.
I mean, I've coached players who parents have said that. And, you know, I've seen them, coach them, and also been around parents who... when you told them, you know, maybe you've been a bit, you know, it's a bit much this, they've gone, well, that's not what Richard Williams did. And, you know, it all comes from, basically, it comes from Richard Williams' own mouth, even before the film. That was before a film was made. Yeah. And look at all the examples of people who've tried to copy Richard Williams and have failed with that. And all the people who haven't tried necessarily to copy Richard Williams, but have done the same thing and have failed. But at the same time, it does take, you do need to be pushy and a little bit crazy. You know,
and interesting though, like, it's not just about developing a tennis player. Like, if you think about, take Coco Gauff, for example, who's had, you know, a father very involved in her tennis career, but she is, I don't think it's a coincidence that he is A, one of the parents who kind of is willing to take a step back and let other people come in and coach his daughter, and B, she is one of the most well-rounded, interesting, you know, intelligent individuals on the tour. I don't think that's a coincidence. And I was, you know, I was listening to a football podcast today and people talking about why Ange Postecoglou, the Tottenham manager, is different. And people saying, well, it's because he kind of recognises that there's a human side to football as well as just, you know, being a tactician. And I think it's the same with maybe being a tennis coach or a tennis parent.
I think, like, I mean, I'll give a specific example actually on this, that 3 or 4 weeks ago, a friend of mine in America called me and he said, oh, there's a, he coaches at a country club. And he said, oh, there's a kid here who's he's half Bulgarian, half English. He's 14. His dad wants a full-time tennis coach to travel with him. And he was like, I've advised him that he should get in touch with you. And he's gone, you know, you should take it. And he was like, he's going like, you know, this guy is, he's got so much money. You'd be looking at six-figure salary plus all expenses and that kind of thing. And I said, you know, I said, well, for starters, I already have two players who I coach, so I'm not available. And he was going like, but yeah, but it's this six figures, Cal, it's six, you know, six-figure salary he's willing to pay. And I was like, oh, okay, what? Who was his last coach? And he's, well, he's had like three in the last year. And I goes, well, it's not a six-figure salary then, is it? Because it's that amount for 2 months. That's what it is. You know, it's like if somebody is, if they're sacking coaches and getting changing coaches every 3 months. And as well, and I said as well, on top of that, at 14 years old and at the level that he is, and he told me what his ranking was in ITF, like, you don't need a full-time tennis coach. And anyone who's telling you that is basically ripping you off.
Because so, yeah. he's not of a level where it's going to make a difference, or
he's not of a level. Yeah, I mean, and I said, you know, like, I don't know what you know what why you'd need a full-time tennis coach at that, because at the level that he is and what he's hoping to achieve, just having a coach with him will just put a target on his back, and you know, he's going to go. And you've seen it happen, you know. There's, oh, that guy's there. He's got two coaches with him. He's got a coach and a fitness trainer, and all that kind of thing. And but yeah. The idea that, like I said, the idea that, you know, it's a six-figure salary, it wasn't, because, you know, you'd take the job. It's like saying, you know, I guess it's like a very good female British tennis player that we talk about with the salary that she might pay. And that it's not, because she changes coaches quite regularly.
Yes, no one's ever actually managed to get a whole year of that salary. So
yeah, exactly.
Sorry, George.
to return to the original question, is it unfair to already say that Tsitsipas's career has been ruined by his parents and that promise hasn't been lived because he's not had the right environment around him to take him to that next level? Whereas Rune, now he's back with Muratoglu, as we've wrote in our newsletter this week, James. Who knows? We'll have to.
I mean, if you haven't read George's excellent piece about Patrick Muratoglu, please check your inboxes.
I don't think that's a bit harsh, though, George, because Tsitsipas has been a better player than Rune so far. Like, what he's done with his career is he's achieved more than Rune has. In his career, not loads different, but I think it's one of those. It's, I wonder whether with Tsitsipas, it's less. I guess you could term it both ways. Is it ruining it or is it stalling it? In the he's not being allowed to move on because of it. You know, but you know, whatever you say, they've got him to a pretty good place. You know, he's one of the five best tennis players in the world, or was for a while. He's one of the three best for a while. but you get the feeling that what his parents have brought to it have maybe stalled him from going a level up from there.
Yeah, I think ruined would be a strong word at this point.
I was using the term I think was in the email, to be fair, rather than words out my own mouth.
Yeah, okay.
You'd hope that both of them, and this is, I don't know, because I don't want to know about both of them. I don't know whether this will be the case. You'd hope that at some stage they have to step out of it. The concerning thing with Tsitsipas was that he did, but only for a short time, and now he's back in it.
Yeah, I do think at some point you've got to cut the umbilical cord. And you know, I mean, I think it's important to have different voices and to create, you know, to take different views of the game and of your own game. And look, I don't know. I've not worked with Apostolos Tsitsipas. I don't know. Maybe he is someone who does that and takes many different approaches, but he doesn't strike me as that type.
It's just, it's even though, like, it's like on a human level, like, would, if you were in that position, if you were doing that, if you were one of the world's best tennis players and you're traveling the world and the venues that they go to, would you want your parents with you? No, I wouldn't.
You wouldn't catch Benoit Paire with his mum kicking around him, let's put it that way.
I bet Grigor Dimitrov's happy he hasn't had his parents around him the whole time.
Yes, yeah. Come on, Steph. You need to push the boat out a bit.
I mean, you know, what I will say on a serious note, though, is like there are a few pushier parents who have been around a lot than Judy Murray, and her son's had a pretty good career. You know, I think it's you know, you wonder if like maybe Andy hadn't won those slams, would Judy have taken the brunt of that? And go, oh, you know, because that was the line for a long while. His mum's too involved and that kind of thing. And you know, because he kind of won a bit. And but I mean, what I will say, Andy's a whole lot more rounded individual than either of those two guys are, even at the same age he was. I would say.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess like you can see from the parents' perspective. Not to draw this out too long, but like, you can understand the feeling of like you've invested so many years going into this that you would want to kind of make sure you've got the right person in there. I can understand that kind of that feeling of, oh God, if we trust this guy. And, you know, Judy's a decent example. She, you know, she probably with Jamie trusted him with a coach who cocked his forehand up. And then, you know, he was a pretty good player before that. And then you got your younger son who's, you don't want the same mistake sort of made again. You probably would, part of you, be thinking, well, I'm not letting this out my sight anymore. I'm not sure that was the exact dynamic, but you can see how parents get in that headspace, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Well, thanks for all of your questions. If you want to send one in, it's tennisunfiltered@gmail.com. Drop us an email and I'll do my best to either send you a reply and say, well, we can't really do that on the pod, or get it out on the pod. It's, as you can tell, we really enjoy getting those questions and it's a big part of what we do. Anyway, let's move on to the tennis agenda for the last week, shall we? Rafa Nadal made it to Indian Wells but didn't make it as far as his first round match against Milos Raonic, pulling out with an injury. Simona Halep has had her ban reduced and is back playing tennis. She'll be in action in Miami. Katie Bolter went straight from San Diego to Indian Wells and promptly lost in the first round. after the biggest title of her career. Andy Murray picked up a dominant win, but then lost to Andrei Rublev. Netflix has abandoned tennis just days after really, really doubling down on it. And the Queens is going to host a WTA event from 2025, which is quite interesting news. Oh, and Calvin's gone viral on Twitter and remembered how much he hates it. Let's start with Rafa Nadal, though, shall we? Talking of things I hate on Twitter, because I have to say, post-Nadal injury pullout Twitter is one of the worst discourses ever. Let's add some sense to this discourse. Calvin, I mean, he wanted to play. He went there early. He was trying to get fit. You get to, you know, T-2, and you're like, well, I'm not going to be fit enough here. Isn't it quite reasonable what the way he's done it?
Yeah, I mean, my position has stayed the same. I think he thinks he's got a chance of winning the French Open, and I think he's not going to do anything that potentially, even if it's 2 or 3%, anything that jeopardizes that. I think he's looking at everything in that. I think at some stage he will have to play some matches because it's just been... I think normally, I mean, he's gone into the French or any slams before without any match practice and won them, but he's never had this long out. Like, he's basically been out for a year or more. It was Australian Open last year, wasn't it, that he played his last match before he went back to Australia this year. And I think he's only played 3 matches since then. But I think he's looking at it. I wouldn't look at it that... he's injured again now. I don't think that's the case. He was playing pretty cleanly the other day in Vegas. So I think it's more. I don't think it's more. He's injured, so he's pulled out. I think it's always a precaution of, right, what gives me the best chance of winning the French Open this year.
I mean, it's funny because we in the past when we spoke about Nadal pulling out of things, it isn't the same. But given the kind of time, but we've always said he doesn't play tournaments if he doesn't think he can win them, and he has used his usual kind of excuse. It is an interesting dynamic now, isn't it? Whether it's, does he actually just think he can't compete at this sort of tournament, full stop, in his current condition? Is he actually going to get into that position without playing some matches? Or is it, as Calvin says, just such a pure plan of, I have to make the French Open and everything else kind of falls by the wayside? But I do kind of feel if it's the latter, it makes less sense to me to bother going out to kind of Indian Wells and Miami. And you know, I find it harder to believe he wouldn't necessarily know, he wouldn't, you know, that late decision coming had there not been a kind of further slight setback or problem. I don't know. It's hard to get in his head there for me.
I think it's more that, you know, with those kinds of things, I think especially, I know because I'm much older than Nadal actually, but you know, when you start getting to that age, I think you can start feeling things. And again, completely different levels that I'm talking about here, but I'm pretty active and still played football and tennis when I was, you know, from Nadal's age and a bit older. You start thinking, yeah, you know, the hamstring's a little bit tight today. Do I want to really play with that? Or maybe it's nothing. Maybe I'd be fine if I played with it. Do I want to risk it? Probably not, you know, so I'll just wait and I'll just keep plowing on. And I think he's probably thought, if I can somewhere get 10 matches in before the French Open, 8 to 10 matches, and then the French, that gives me my best shot. I don't need to be doing all 7 of them or 6 of them this week in order to do that. And he's probably looked at it and thought, you know, if I do that, does that give me the best chance? But no.
There's probably a degree to which he knows himself as well, doesn't he? And he knows as soon as he's on that court, he can't do anything other than give 100% like a raging bull and won't be able to hold back. And if he is, you know, as you say there, Calvin, is feeling a tight hamstring or whatever it is and does get on the court, he probably would struggle to take that adrenaline down and not kind of just go full out at it.
I mean, as well, something else I'd say is that, you know, Nadal is someone throughout his career who has pulled out of a lot of tournaments. Like, it's not somebody who, you know, who churns them out. He's not Andrei Rublev or Holger Rune or somebody like that who plays or team in his prime. He's somebody who's, you know, he's had a lot of withdrawals. You know, it was levelled at him a good few years ago that he just refused to. He wouldn't let anybody beat him, and if he thought he wasn't going to win, he'd just pull out. or you know, he's pulled out in matches a lot of the time when people have been beating him. So, I think he's always been mega precautious with it, and you know, he's proven to be right with it. He's won more slams than anybody else, bar one person in history.
Yeah, and for the record, just because it was brought up a lot, And they pre-publicised when he was going to play his first round match a lot, like well in advance, unusually so. And it was going to be the Thursday night match. Of course, they sold lots of tickets for that. And then, of course, people were saying, well, I don't want to watch... Well, I mean, my point would be Sumit Nagal is not that different from Rafa Nadal, but people seem to think there was a big difference.
Just 20 slams.
And in fairness to Indian Wells organisers, they did offer full refunds to anyone who had bought a ticket for the Thursday night session, which... by the looks of the stadium for Nagal versus Rajnic, a lot of people took them up on. I know there were some problems, like you had to ring them up, and obviously there was a massive queue at the beginning, but I can't imagine that refund's going to expire. I do feel sorry if people have booked, and I did read one or two stories, it's hard to know how true they are because of their sources, but about people booking last-minute flights out and stuff. Mm. But, that's the nature of tennis, I'm afraid. It could happen to anyone. Like, it happens all the time, and it's one of the problems with the sport is the unpredictability of it. And sometimes it's avoidable, and sometimes I sort of think it just isn't. And
it's always easier to support a team rather than a player. You know they're going to turn up even if they're bloody hopeless. Like Villa were at the weekend.
Well, I don't know. Man United don't often turn up, which only Calvin supports. For the record, for a listener, I can't remember who it was. Yeah. Someone gave us grief for all being Man United fans and questioning the validity of that. We're not all Man United fans. I'm a Liverpool fan, and George is an Aston Villa fan.
I was biting my tongue when you were talking about Postecoglou earlier, James. I thought, you bastard, you've just rubbed that in for no reason, bringing out unnecessarily.
You can blame John McGinn, George. That's the only person you can blame.
I still think that red was half. we're not a football podcast, so we'll leave that one and let me get over
it. Football Unfiltered, maybe that'll be our subscription product. Right, moving on, I think. I don't know how much more there is to say about that. So Simona Halep, of which there is plenty to say, and I look forward to editing this section heavily when I've gone through the legals. Right, let's deal with some facts, shall we? Because I know we can't get sued on that. Simona Halep was initially banned by the ITAA for 4 years, having tested positive for Roxadustat, a banned substance. She was then subsequently also charged with altering her or manipulating her athlete's biological passport, ABP. She appealed, naturally. The appeal took a long time, and it was finally heard by the Court of Arbitration for Sport in Switzerland last week now, and her ban was reduced from 4 years to 9 months, which, even in the realms of CAS reductions of bans, of which there are many, and we'll probably discuss that going forward, is pretty significant. They ruled that she had not intentionally doped. That was what they interpreted the evidence presented to them as, that she had obviously taken the substance, but inadvertently, and as a result of a contaminated supplement. They also rejected the ABP charge entirely, which one person I spoke to said is going to make it quite hard for anyone making an ABP charge stick in future. I don't pretend to understand the intricacies of athlete's biological passport, so I'm not going to get into it too much. But... Calvin, I know you've been having a lot of arguments on Twitter this week about it, so I guess one of your big gripes is with CAS, right?
I have a big gripe with CAS. I mean, I have two gripes. I have a gripe with CAS, and I also have a gripe with tennis fans or fans of any sport just thinking that somebody is innocent because they really like that person and based on nothing. And I'll come to the CAS one first. CAS have I believe they have a track record of always favouring the athlete, and I think athlete stroke team, and I think the athlete stroke team are well aware of that. Athlete stroke teams are well aware of that, and if they've got the money to take it that far, they always favour. And I know this because I've spoken with people around people who've been to CAS with cases, not necessarily on doping cases, but on other things as well. And I know it's quite well publicised that I don't wish to go into football too much, but with the Manchester City situation a couple of years ago, that Man City were always when everything pointed to them being banned from the Champions League, they were always confident that if they were going to get it to CAS, that they would get away with it. And the premise was CAS will favour the teams more than the governing bodies. Mm. And I think that is what has happened here. I don't really think anything has changed in the facts that came from there. You know, I know there were two conflicting opinions of various scientists as to what happened with Halep, but there was no new evidence came to light for CAS to deal with. Just as always, they decide that the ban is too long and they reduce the ban. That by the time it gets to CAS, it is generally they've been whatever the team or the athlete has been banned for some while, so they just reduce it to that period of time and then they're back competing again. And that is what's happened. The second part is, like I say, I've seen numerous people on Twitter. I've had people come to me who just, and it's not just fans. This is tennis players as well. There's been a lot of tennis player support for Simona Halep. That seems to be that it's ridiculous that she has tested positive for anything because she's our friend, and or she's our favourite player.
Not that sort of player in football.
Yeah, parlance. Exactly. Yeah, and again, you know, and it's like, well, she declared her innocence from the off. There's still never been in the history of sport. There's still never been, with the exception of Lance Armstrong, years after he was found to be doping, who admitted. He's the only one who has ever admitted that he was doping. All of the others, in the immediacy, have always claimed that there's absolutely no way that they were.
Hmm. And does Lance Armstrong now sort of, like, recant some of that confession? I see he does a lot of podcasting and stuff, and I feel like he sort of mealy-mouthed, undermines his own confession.
I think his point is that he was by far the best anyway, so it was irrelevant. But yeah, he's like, I think it's like, from what I can make out, and I've listened to him, I get sent bits and bats and that kind of thing of it. I think he just points out that basically everyone was doing it anyway, so it's irrelevant that I was, and it's obvious I was way better than everyone else anyway, so even if I wasn't doing it, then I would still have won all those races. Yeah. I think that's his position on it. But, you know, whether it was intentional, and again, it comes back that I think people seem to be getting around it from what I've seen on Twitter and what have you, that the idea that, yeah, well, maybe she did have that in her body, but she didn't know about it. She it wasn't used intentionally. But there's strict liability on this, that you can't get away from that.
Mm. Yeah, and that's exactly why she was still banned for a period of time rather than just exonerated entirely. Yeah, look, the facts are that the most recent judgment and the Court of Appeal has ruled that Simona Halep did not intentionally dope, and therefore we have to accept that. There is no further Court of Appeal in this particular case. As you say, Calvin, there is a track record here of CAS providing compromise. What people probably aren't aware of is it's not like CAS is part of some, like, mandated judicial system. CAS is not compulsory. It is chosen by the tennis authorities as their court of appeal. There are other courts of appeal out there. If you take Tara Moore's case, for example, which didn't go to appeal, but it did go to an independent panel, which is the same kind of thing as CAS, that was convened by Sporting Resolutions, who are the other quite big kind of resolution, you know, conflict resolution body out there. They are a business like anyone else. They want repeat business. And I'm of the opinion, and it's not really just my opinion, it comes from a lot of very well-placed sources, that CAS has become a court of compromise. And that if the sporting, you know, in these cases, and I'm talking in general terms here and not in Simona Halep's case specifically, although it happens to be one like that, if you give the athlete their exoneration and you give the integrity body, you know, whether it's UCAD, USADA, whoever it happens to be, and you give them their ban, everyone sort of goes away happy because they've had their ban. We banned someone, they doped, we banned them, and then they challenged it, but we still didn't lose. And the player gets a shorter ban, and also crucially gets the bit that says, I didn't cheat deliberately.
I think the thing what in the bigger picture that concerns me about this is that there has to be cheating in tennis because it's human nature, it's the way of life. People will cheat. And people in sport, when there's huge amounts of money available or in question, they will cheat. Somebody will be cheated. There's rumours going around all the time about who's doing what and that kind of thing in all sports. And it does happen. And the percentage of athletes in all sports that have been caught to be cheating is ridiculously low for how much it must be going on. And in tennis in particular, it is minuscule, absolutely minuscule. And we're not helping matters if every time we do find somebody to be doping, and I'm not specifically talking about Halep here, but every time we do find somebody that if they say they've definitely not been doing it, people on Twitter if it's one of their favourite players or someone from their country, they immediately leap to the defence of them. And if CAS just come in and go, yeah, all right, we'll deal with this one. You know, we're never going to get any sort of level playing field if that's what we do. Now, moving on from that, what I would say, and I know, James, you did an excellent interview with Marcel de Coudray, who represents, who coaches Camille. I'm not going to attempt his last name.
Yeah, good point. You know, I looked it up and listened to the ATP pronunciation guide, and I'm still struggling. So Camille, it is.
And Marcel is a friend of mine and has been for many years. We don't always agree on many things, to be honest. But we had a little bit of an argument on Twitter, but it wasn't about his case. It was about the process that he's gone through. And Marcel made a lot of good points that I entirely agree with. While I think we really need to button down on doping and cheating in sport in general, in particular tennis, the people who do the testing, and what I always forget what they're called. What is it? What is the acronym?
It's the International Tennis Integrity Agency.
Yeah. And I don't know whether it's them who do it or whether it's whether they employ a doping governing body or something. The people who do it, they are bullies. They are overly aggressive for no reason with players who, you know, all logic would point to this is not who we should be aiming at. If you want to run a sophisticated, complex doping system on a tennis player, you need a lot of money to do it. You need a governing body behind you, or you need a lot of finance behind it. It can't, for anyone who knows anything about what it takes to successfully dope at sport, you need a lot of money. And there's things that would point to certain people who may be doing that. Whereas the people who do the drug testing in tennis, they're uncompromising, and you think, well, what are you doing? What is this person likely to be one of the people you're aiming at? And I realize it kind of has to be randomized. I've seen players roll ankles. I've seen they've rolled their ankle and there's been ligament damage. They're screaming in pain. They can't walk. And as they're being stretched off or on crutches, the doping people are telling them, you need to pee into this bottle immediately. Hmm. And you think, you know, and I'm talking about guys who maybe like 800 in the world and are in no particular type of form to suggest they're going any higher than that. And that's that sort of situation. Their position is always everyone is cheating and it's up to you to point to prove otherwise. And I
can see how that is an unpleasant situation to be in, and I can see how as an athlete that's probably pretty worrying. But I also, and you kind of acknowledge it there, Calvin, it kind of has to be that way, doesn't it?
Like, I just think that there could be a little bit more understanding in certain situations, James. I think there is a little more humanity that can go into it without necessarily letting everybody off. And that kind of thing, you know, if somebody has rolled their ankle, well, I'll use a specific example with Henry, who I coached. I might have told this on the pod before that summer 2022, he was playing a futures tournament at Nottingham after Wimbledon, and he slipped on the grass and put his back out. He slipped a disc in his back. He was out for about 6 weeks, I think, and he was in. And Henry's a big lad. He's 6'6", and he was in a lot of pain. And you know, everybody saw the incident where it happened, and he was in a lot of pain, and you know, and the drug tester was immediately like, you need to do this now or you will be charged. And Henry was like, well, can I just go see the physio for 15 minutes and relieve some of this pain? And the guy was uncompromising, absolutely not, no. Now, there's nothing that can happen in that 15 minutes that would change the result of what you're going to get when you get out of there.
Well, not I mean, you can strap a toothpaste tube of fresh urine to your todger.
Yeah, but I mean, again though, James, not at 15K futures level. You know, I think it's like, you know, this is where I mean that, like, yeah, if in certain circumstances, I get it. But, you know, at the Tour de France, when you've got, you know, millions and millions of pounds running, you know, paying for mopeds to take blood transfusions around and that kind of thing, fair enough. But I just think there's a little bit of common sense that could go into it, and there's no need to be bullies into it. I think that that's the thing that, you know, I do think there's some, I think there's compromise to be made at the start of, with both of these things. I think that, you know, with the governing bodies and the doping authorities, I think they need to be a little bit better in how they do, just as well in terms of like, and I know it's not black and white on this, not perfect science, but they're asking tennis players, where are you going to be on this date? it's impossible for tennis players to know where they're going to be on a particular day, especially.
But this is the whereabouts.
You can change
right?
it.
You can change it up to 24 hours in advance or something, or even later than that.
Yeah,
I think.
And I think that they, you know, often they do, you know, it's doable. But you know, tennis players, they're on. There might be situations where, you know, they've lost in a tournament and they need to get to the next tournament, or they need to get home to save their. You know, save a night's accommodation or something like that. I think that that's where the issue is. I don't think, you know, and I'm speaking purely lower down the levels here. I think once you get into top 100, you know, that's where there should be more questions asked, that kind of thing. I don't think that, you know, for example, a guy ranked 800 who's got a winning percentage of like 40% throughout the year and isn't really going anywhere and is, you know, 26 years old or something. I don't think that's the person who WADA need to be making sure that they follow them into the toilet all the time with. And I do get it. It also has to be randomised, but I mean, me and the lads joke a little bit actually, because Henry and Luke seem to get tested at every tournament. So I don't. And then when we went to County Cup last week, 18's County Cup again, they were running tests there. There was somebody from WADA.
No, they drug tested County Cup. Wow.
Yeah, first time ever this time.
Right.
And it's only when I was there, and I was saying to Henry and Luke, I was like, I don't know what kind of like system they think I'm running out here, out of my place in Barnsley.
Discredit the podcast.
Some real Dr. Fuentes shit down here.
that's not a guitar case behind Calvin.
They seem to be, but they seem to have targeted Luke and Henry specifically, and then my County Cup team. So you know, maybe they know something that I don't.
They do quite often release the amount of times players have been. Spoken to, don't they? Well, they certainly have in the past.
Well, I know that Marcel, I know he told me last week, I don't know how legit this is, or I don't know whether he's got actual facts about this. He claims that the top players basically never get tested.
I'm now I've said that, I'm wondering if this actually was a leak years ago, but there was definitely a year where they kind of pulled out. There was
wasn't it a Happy Bears or whatever that great
that
leaking
instead.
Group was called. But Djokovic got tested at Davis Cup, didn't he? And he whinged about it.
I think it's, you know, it's one of those. The players often don't help themselves either. Like I've said before on the pod, that nonsense with Djokovic having his trainer mix his drink at the side of the court and then being very secretive about what it is that he's mixing in there was just an absolute nonsense, because that starts shining a light and then he's kicking off when he's tested, and you think, well, you're just drawing attention to yourself on that there. So
yeah.
I struggle to have a whole lot of sympathy with that. I think there's just nuances that could be done better, but I also think the players and fans and coaches also have to give a little bit as well.
I mean, the other point I'd just make about this whole thing is, you know, we're talking about how often we get to a point where we have someone proved beyond doubt of any certainty that they're not guilty of, so that they are guilty of actually doing this. It's amazing how many times we're able to prove that something's contaminated, where I really just can't imagine there's any actual evidence for that beyond them saying this is contaminated. It must be so hard to go back and find that thing that was contaminated and prove contamination, when actually Occam's razor would suggest it's more likely to me that they are cheating. And I think that really does go to the heart of this, you know, from that intent perspective. Why would you believe it's contaminated? That just feels so much more convenient to me. Again, I'm not speaking about Halep here. I'm just saying that is a defence that's used all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you weigh up the two, I don't know how many numbers we're talking about of people who are purely guilty, no way out of it, doping versus contamination. But I suspect that ratio is horribly on the side of contamination, to the point where it just can't be the case.
Doesn't seem statistically likely, does it?
I think as well, you know, I don't know loads about doping in sport. I read a couple of the books about the Balco situation, about it in cycling and that kind of thing, and through little bits that I know about tennis and people I've spoke to about tennis and doctors and that kind of thing. But there are certain players, and absolutely not going to name any names here, but there are certain players who...
You're learning?
but there are certain players, and I know because we've discussed them privately between us three and amongst tennis players and that kind of thing. They're the players that whose runs of form suggest that something isn't entirely as it may be, in terms of out of nowhere they suddenly start winning matches and then they disappear for 2 to 3 months and that kind of thing. There's certain patterns that emerge that you think, I hope they're getting tested. I hope we're putting a little bit more into that rather than just testing a load of people that you think, well, they've shown no suggestion whatsoever that they would be doping. And even if they are, it's certainly not working because they haven't won a match in like 8 months or something like that.
Indeed. Well, I think we've managed to get through that whole section without anything I'm going to have to cut out because we're going to get sued. So, well done, chaps. I look forward to receiving a legal letter contrary to that particular opinion, but we'll see how it goes.
Maybe the ATP as a whole, perhaps.
Just on while my dog complains about not being allowed to go out, I've got Indian Wells on in the background. I had 4 technical errors on the Raducanu match before it would actually let me view it, but I have managed to get it on. Raducanu and Sabalenka playing each other, both sponsored by Nike. Have they got different outfits on? No, they are both wearing all pink dresses. I know that this has been discussed before. Bloody hell! Like,
the only time it was vaguely acceptable was when Zverev and team turned up as zebras to play each other. And that was very funny.
I do find that crazy that kind of thing happens, especially seen as, you know, these companies, they have ranges of kits, so they will both have the range, but within a range there are different kits within that. So, you know, I've not got it on, but Sabalenka's top might be it could be the same color as Raducanu's bottoms, or and vice versa. So I don't get why you just wouldn't do that. I mean, I have, you know, the kit situation I find bizarre, and I'll go through this quick. People might not find it remotely interesting, but I know that at the Aussie Open, somebody I know had messaged me saying a particular player was wearing a kit that they liked, and they said they'd gone on the Nike website to try and find it, and it wasn't available on the Nike website. And this was a week into the Australian Open, and that player had been wearing it for the first 2 weeks of the season as well. And so, you know, did I have any idea? You know, we're just talking basically like it's a bit weird that Nike have not got it on. So I know one of the Nike reps, and I got chatting to him at the Aussie Open. And I said to him, you know, I find this a bit, you know, what's the crack here? And he was like, yeah, you know, he's like, it's more like we put the stuff out for branding, but tennis clothes and tennis apparel doesn't really make as much money. And he told me that, and this is what I found amazing, that he said, with the exception of football, Nike make more money from socks than they make from any other sport. and he said that, you know, he said, we will put the gear on the website eventually, but we're in no rush because we don't do that many numbers.
The conversion isn't there, correct?
Yeah, but more socks than any sport other than football.
Which feels amazing, doesn't it, really? Like, from whether you're watching your favourite player or not, I mean, there must be so many people playing these sports everywhere who do need to go and buy some gear. Like, it doesn't have to be your watch.
I do think, though, George, I know, like, and again, I don't wish to go all in my day type thing here. But but we were talking about it the other day that, like, you know, you buy the kit of your favourite player before, because they used to have 2 different kits in a season. It used to be, well, they used to have 3. It was Australian Open to Wimbledon was one, and then Wimbledon they wear an all white, and then post Wimbledon to the end of the year they'd wear that kit. So you knew that I'm going to get the Agassi kit from 92, start of the year, or I'm going to get the Sampras kit 94 to the end of the year. Whereas now they churn out so many kits that you couldn't, I mean, it's almost a kit every other, it's a kit every swing for sure. Like, these kits that the players are wearing now is not the same kits that they were, it's not the same range that they wore in the Aussie Open. It won't be the same range that they wear for the clay court season. Then they'll go Wimbledon, they'll have a kit to the end of the US Open, and then there'll be a new kit to the end of the year. And it's just too many to be getting your favourite players.
This is a very random tangent, I do apologise, but it's just sparked something in my head randomly. I was reading a book this week that said, I know, shocking. I've been reading a lot more over the last year. It's very odd, James, and what's going on.
Turn up on time, maybe.
there was a stat in there that I think this was written around COVID time, but he was saying that the average American buys 71 items of clothing a year.
A year?
A year, the average. I could not believe
the average.
I was trying to think how many items of clothing I personally buy a year. Like, My mum generally buys more of my clothes than I actually buy. Like,
I might touch somewhere near that, I think.
You reckon? If you include, like, is a pair of socks is an individual item?
I would assume so, yeah.
I mean, I think I bought 7 pairs of trainers this year already.
Crikey. Yeah. I mean, that's... Do you wear them all?
I wear them. I don't wear them. I don't. Yeah, I mean, I went to Thailand and got some maybe not particularly legit Air Jordans. So, but yeah, I wear them all, but I probably don't wear them as much as I should, you know. I mean, just in terms of kit that we get, I mean, I have a deal with Yonex, Luke has a deal with LS, Henry has a deal with Lotto, and they send out a phenomenal amount of kit.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, even to me, it's like, you know, I get it for them, for the players, because they, you know, they're going to need 5 of the same shirt and that kind of, then 5 of a slightly different shirt. But they'll send me it, and it's like, I don't need 3 of the same match kit. Yeah. Don't play any matches, for starters.
Right, should we move on? Sorry for that tangent, that's entirely my fault. Katie Bolter celebrated the best result of her career by getting thoroughly thumped by Camille Georgie. Someone, I think, probably quite fairly pointed out that the conditions between San Diego and Indian Wells couldn't be much more different, I think. Georgie, 6-3, 6-2. I don't know how much we really want to dwell on this, but this is not great, is it?
When you said someone quite fairly pointed out, I thought you were about to suggest that I would quite fairly pointed out she was going to lose first round this week. After that, because that is exactly what happens every bloody time. And you look, that result shouldn't put a damper on what she did before. But you know, she's got a great opportunity now where she's going to be seeded at so many big events for a while and have, you know, Camille Georgie is all right. You shouldn't be losing 6-2, 6-3 to her. Like, if you know, if you want to prove you're at that level, and I said last week, you know, I still think Bolter falls quite short on like really good, solid wins right at the top of the game. And maybe that's a little bit harsh. You know, she did have some good wins last week, but generally speaking, I think a lot of her body of work is better draws that she takes advantage of rather than mixing it with the best, as I would expect kind of someone in the top 30 to do. You know, she's got a great chance to prove us all wrong, that she's going to start winning a lot of these early rounds and consolidate this ranking, and she's got a great chance to fly higher up that ranking. Previous history suggests to me that that's not going to happen, but I hope I'm wrong. But I did call that last week, and I'm quite pleased from a prediction perspective, even if I'm disappointed that she didn't build on that great form.
Yes, and for such a short match, I think it deserves a short section in what is already quite a long podcast.
I'll just comment on it a bit, because I think that, you know, I see a lot of players, and I know we're going to get onto doubles later, but I see a lot of singles players talking about, you know, and I saw the interview with Katie, and she, although she never said it implicitly, she hinted like, you know, yeah, it's a quick turnaround, obviously, but I need to park that now, even though it's going to be really tough to do that. And it was like, sort of like, yeah, you know, you had 3 days off. It wasn't like you had to play straight away. And, you know, we'll talk about people slagging off doubles players a bit later on. But I know earlier this year, for example, well, earlier this year, a couple of weeks ago, that Julian Cash and Rob Galloway had to play a final in Delray Beach that was rained off. They had to play their final on a Monday on a hard court in Delray Beach, immediately leave the tournament site, get a flight to Rio, which was overnight, the quickest flight that they could possibly get, and play on a different surface the next afternoon. So less than 24 hours, and they played Salisbury and Ram, and they won. And, you know, that's something you've got to do. It's not ideal, but it's something you've got to do. And I think sometimes players, they look at it and go, you know, they kind of like check out a little bit within themselves, like, it's okay if I lose this one.
Yeah, I suppose some players are better at than others. Like, I suppose you would look at Katie Bolter's career to this point and say she's quite like surface. I don't know, reliant is the right word, but like she's someone who performs well on the surfaces that she's good on. And I would say that Indian Wells is not conditions that you would expect her to perform well in, full stop. Like, she's good indoors, she's good on grass. Like, outside of that, Not many. Oh my God. Sorry, I've just been distracted by the most absurd moonball point in Sabalenka Raducanu. I don't know if you saw the clip this week of Wozniacki Kerber from about 15 years ago going round of some really silly moonballing, but that was completely insane. Sorry, I've completely forgotten what we were talking about. If you're watching or you want to watch back, 5-2, 30 love in the first set, it's very silly. 5-2, love 15. 2-5, love 15, there you go. There's the point. Rewind if you can make Sky work.
It wasn't working, by the way, the other day. The multi-screen was off again the other day.
Yeah. Someone texted me asking if I'd been using it. I wasn't watching at the time, but they were saying they couldn't get it on either.
It does keep breaking.
Has anyone else noticed? Go on, sorry, James.
Well, we're not still in the kind of teething problems range. Are we giving them that?
I don't know whether either of you guys or whether any of our listeners have done it, but I noticed that on mine, when you go multi-screen, it tends to work for about 40 minutes and then cuts, and then if you go out and back in, it works fine again for another 40 minutes.
Oh, weird. Yeah, not a good start, but as long as it gets better, that's all we really ask.
I do, there are elements of that are good. I find it easy. It's easier to navigate, I think, than Amazon was. Mm. It's all there. I think what I do like about it is when there's multiple tournaments on, you don't have to switch between tournaments. They're all on the same menu. This is the match that you want to watch.
Yeah, that does make life easier. Speaking of tennis on TV, there will be less of it next year because Breakpoint has terminated. They have abandoned filming of the third series due to poor ratings and concerns over access to the sport's leading players, according to Stu Fraser of The Times. They have binned it. The day after, I think, the golf series Full Swing came out, the second series of that, which has wildly beaten tennis in the ratings. I'm not sure I'm hugely surprised, given that the last series went from 12 episodes down to 6. I think the writing was on the wall when they did that. George, give us your thoughts.
Well, I'm not surprised from the perspective of didn't exactly capture my imagination watching this. So I can't really say it comes as a huge shock that other people haven't been tuning in. It's disappointing, but we have spoken about this before, so I guess I won't labour too many of the points. But you comparing to golf there, James. To me, I think there's a lot more interesting stories in tennis than in golf. And I think that from a kind of general, or at least I think the potential's there for better stories to be told, stories to a wider audience. You know, I say all the time about tennis, like, it's one of those sports that a lot of people won't know what's going on week to week. But when tennis stories break, they break bloody big. And it's quite often the angle that you have near equal pay, or at least equal pay in the biggest tournaments that most people are kind of tuning into. You have men and women kind of competing at a very high level together, which, you know, other sports are really playing catch up on, and tennis has been doing that for a long time, is a lot more established. You have great dynamics of people who can't afford to make a living at a lot tighter range than many other sports. So, you know, imagine being the best 200 person in whatever career you choose and struggling to kind of make a career from that. That is what's happening in tennis. I think there's a real interesting kind of socioeconomical male, female, ridiculous wealth versus kind of, you know, relatively close kind of poverty in inverted commas, but you know what I mean. Like, it's hard to make a kind of career from it. I think tennis has the potential to be one of the most interesting sports to tell a story about. And what kind of happened, and I think this is a problem with tennis full stop, to be honest, like, it was just the most sanitized, boring piece of shit you can find, and telling the least interesting stories possible. And, you know, I'm sorry, this podcast for me has a bit of an MO because the rest of the tennis world is unwilling to actually speak like normal human beings and just have a bit of a chat. And I'm not saying we're perfect by any stretch, but that is where I think, you know, the coverage is just so painfully sanitized in so many different ways that I don't understand why you'd watch it and be interested if you don't start off having an interest in tennis. And I think that's a huge bloody problem. And it's pervaded into a product that had a chance to change that perception and get people interested, and it just fell so far bloody short of what it should have done that really, I don't know exactly where I'm pointing the finger of blame, whether it's, you know, certain players not wanting to get involved, poor choice from directors. I don't really know who I'm like swinging my giant metal rod at here, James, but it's a problem, a cultural problem with tennis as a whole, that people are quite often afraid to be interesting, quite often afraid to have a strong opinion, and quite often it comes up really short. And it's a shame, because I think there's loads of really interesting stories. I think it's undersold in a lot of kind of, even in our, well, my former industry and your current industry, James, there's not enough room given to what could be really interesting stories out there. And I just don't think the sport helps itself. And this is another real bloody own goal that, you know, it's impossible to measure the impact, but no one even knows this series exists outside of people who already follow tennis. That's my general analysis. And yeah, I know loads of people know what's going on in golf. I know loads of people what's going on in F1. Who gives a crap about them? Come on. The stories aren't there comparatively, in a nice way. I know I'm biased, but I do genuinely think, you know, golf and F1 is really just full of kind of posh millionaires, and that's about it. It's not more a lot of real story.
Well, it's funny you say that, actually, because I watched the first series of Full Swing, and the best stories were Joel Damon, who is just a bloke who gets drunk quite a lot and turns up hungover.
There's a few of them in tennis, I can tell
and,
you that.
Yeah, exactly. but also recovered from cancer and is a really down to earth guy and a compelling, and you know, was fighting for his life literally, and then fighting for his golf life as well. And a few other players trying to get their card or trying to keep their card. They were the really compelling stories. I don't really care about Ian Poulter hitting drives out of his back door on his $13 million estate and saying, "Oh, I just had to go for the money. I needed it." So yeah, Calvin, I don't suppose you're particularly surprised that they've cancelled it either.
I mean, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, mainly because shows that are rubbish will get cancelled. And I've coached on the professional tour now for about, I can't say 15 years. I'm not adding them up. In that time, the number of things I've thought, you know, in situations I've been in or situations I've witnessed where I thought there's a hell of a TV series in this that people would love to watch. And none of those were watching the top players in the world talk about tennis. And that's what this show was. And I think that's the big miss. Now, I think this is relevant. There's a French tennis player called Jules Marie who takes a cameraman round with him.
He's a YouTuber.
But he's not, I mean, it's hard to call him a YouTuber because he's also a very good player. This is not an influencer that we're dealing with here, but he has a cameraman with him. Now, his YouTubes are 50 times more interesting than anything that appeared on Point Break. And I don't think they're particularly great. You know, I don't think his story is particularly great. But
you mean Breakpoint, Calvin? Point. I won't have you slandering that fine Keanu Reeves film, Point Break.
I do mean that. No, that's actually because I spent the whole afternoon making an argument that Point Break is one of the best action films ever made.
It's great. It's completely absurd. Like, the script is horrific, but it's
I'll come back to my original point in a minute, but I feel I should say this because we are a bit different in that. We got into it because what continues to baffle me is Patrick Swayze's career arc after Point Break. Because in Point Break, he's phenomenal. Right, he's absolutely phenomenal. He's a superstar. He's maybe the best action star in the world. He's just made Dirty Dancing. He's made Roadhouse, which is also a classic. Mm. And then he's made Point Break. And you think this is and then after that, James, I know James is getting his IMDb up right now. There's not another film. He doesn't make another film that anyone's ever heard about. It's like, I don't know who was advising him in this period, but it's just catastrophic.
Yeah. It just goes off a cliff. I mean, it was the mid-90s, but even so.
Yeah, amazing stuff. But yeah, back to my original point. where was I? Yeah, so, I do mean Breakpoint, sorry, yeah. I don't think Jules Marie's YouTubes are particularly great. I do find them quite interesting sometimes. But you think of the stories that you could have. Like, I was talking with my mate this afternoon. There's a lad from Syria called Hazem, I don't know his surname. He's a Syrian tennis player. And if you spend a bit of time with Hazem talking about tennis, like, his story is phenomenal. He would leave his house to train. He's from Damascus. He would leave his house to train. And he said, not knowing when he got there, whether the tennis courts would be there. And when he left to walk back, he didn't know whether his house would be there. And he used to do this every day. And now he's managed to get out of Syria. He lives in Germany, I think. He can't go back to Syria because I think he's supposed to be like conscripted or something like that. Hmm. But his story is phenomenal. And you think, how have we missed this huge opportunity? The doubles tour, for example, has so much. I know even now there's pairs now who are... There's a lot of established pairs in doubles now who things are not going great for them at the start of the year. And, you know, there's a natural drama there of, you know, they've had a lot of success in the past. It's not working now. And, you know, some interesting characters as well who are not constrained by agents and PR people telling them, don't say this, don't say that, else we could lose this partnership deal and we don't want to do that. The doubles players would speak openly. And I know I work on it, people may say I'm biased and we'll talk about it more in a bit, but... If there was a Netflix show about the doubles tour, and it was done well with good producers and a good director, I am certain that it would do as well as any of the sporting documentaries on Netflix or on Amazon or anything like that. And it really makes me mad that tennis has just been so slack with this and just such a missed opportunity.
And it does seem, Calvin, that doubles getting sidelined is becoming a running theme of this podcast, and you're right to draw attention to it. And this week, rather a lot of attention drawn to it after another doubles draw falling apart. We often talk about WTA draws falling apart, but doubles draws fall apart basically through withdrawals. I will read back your tweet for people who haven't seen it. Broken record here, but 12 all-singles pairs in the doubles draw at Indian Wells. 3 withdrew without playing a match. 5 lost first round. 2 haven't played yet. I'm not sure if we've got an update on those results. And the 2 other pairs played each other. How long before we sort out this ridiculous entry system?
The other 2 lost last night, by the way.
There you go.
And there's another... Can you just read that? Because I haven't got it up, James.
Meanwhile, you have doubles players ranked inside the top 35 in the world who can't play Masters in Masters tournaments and can't get any higher because they don't have access to the higher-ranking points events. It's a totally broken system, and you're happy, you being the ADP, to let it drag on, sort it. The difference between players ranked 50 and 25 in singles is 400 points. The same difference in doubles is 1,400 points. It's almost impossible for a doubles player to break inside the top 30 with your current entry system. It's a broken system and it isn't a meritocracy.
Yeah, and then there's the one about Paris. Sorry, James. I put.
Oh, yes. In Paris, yeah. 9 all singles players in the draw, all singles pairs in the draw. 4 withdrew without playing a match. 4 of the pairs played each other, so 2 winners there. And those 2 winning pairs immediately withdrew before round 2. The remaining pair lost first round.
And I put that and I got quite a lot of interaction on it. Most of it agreeing with what I was saying. Some particularly weird people who took great offence to it. which, I, you know, again, this really reminds... I often forget how crazy some people are on Twitter and how crazy some tennis... I guess I don't have the interaction that you two have, but you know, so I just... What I wanted to do is just break down some of the... debunk some of the talk of the reasoning behind why this is fine that I've received. And there's 5 points. There's 4 points, then one... There's 5 points, then another one where somebody has suggested something that I just don't really think can happen. So the first one, okay, is that people want to watch singles players. They don't want to watch doubles players. So I posted a video that I took in Australia of Lamans Withrow against Multani Gonzalez, which was in John Cain, and the stadium, I'm going to say, was about 2/3 full. And that's quite a big stadium.
Hmm.
Somebody replied going, yeah, that's just because Tsitsipas was playing after that and people were keeping their seats. Now, I don't think there was a mad rush to watch Tsitsipas in the second round in Australia on John Cain, which was nonsense. But I was there. People were trying to tell me why people... I was there. People were there because they wanted to watch doubles and they were into the match. I then posted... Then he said that. I said, okay, so here's a video of Rome from last year where the stadium was absolutely full. It was Bilelli Fognini against... Erla Miedler. And then he said, oh, that's just because it's Bilelli and Fognini. So it's like, right, so there's no way that we can just have people wanting to watch doubles. It was because it was Bilelli and Fognini, but it showed that people will want to watch doubles of that regard. Linked to that is people go, oh, people don't buy tickets to watch singles players play, to watch doubles players play. They buy tickets to buy singles players. But you buy a ticket to the event. You don't know who's going to be playing unless you're buying for the centre court or a show court, right? You're just buying a ticket to watch tennis. You're not buying it to watch a specific player, whoever goes. And the doubles dad tends not to go on the show courts anyway, apart from the last match. So it doesn't make sense to do that. You're not buying, like now, people have bought tickets to Indian Wells. They haven't gone, shall we buy a ticket for next Wednesday because I think Ben Shelton might be playing doubles that night on court 12. Like, that's not the way it works. Like, and people buy their tickets in advance most of the time anyway. And also, linked into that as well, a third point is this idea. People want to watch singles, not doubles players. They're not watching any singles players because they pull out.
Yeah.
Like, it's like they enter. And it's like the least problem here, I know I've put how many of them lost first round. It's a bit frustrating because they, you know, they enter and they lose first round. That's the least of the problems. I don't even really mind that too much. It's the ones who are entering and then withdrawing either before they play a match or they play a match and occasionally win one and then just withdraw. That's the frustrating thing, that they're in there just to get one match of tennis. And they go, and people will go, well, you know, doubles players can get in as alternates. You can't, I coach, like, Luke would have got in this week if he'd have signed in with his partner. They probably would have got in. He can't just, him and Skander can't just shell out for a flight to Phoenix, flight to Indian Wells. Wait around, because you've got to wait around for 4 days between sign-in and the end of the first round doubles. On the outside chance that there might be enough singles players pull out for you to get a game. Hmm. Like, you just can't do that. Not especially not when, if you don't get in, you've lost a load of money, you haven't got any ranking points, when you can go play ranking point events at the same time. Where am I? Yeah, they're the points.
And now for the lawyers.
No, I think those myths, I think, just need debunking. It's that big one that people only want to watch singles players, but they're not getting to watch them. They're not playing most of the time. They're entering, withdrawing. I think, and I'm sure more people have done this, Cam Norrie has entered Indian Wells this year and last year, been in the draw and hasn't played the doubles match. He's pulled out both times.
Hmm.
This is the problem, the withdrawals. And also, I have no issue with singles players being in on singles ranking, but I think there has to be a limit. I think you've got to put, where I would put it is in a 16-player draw, I would limit it at 2 to 3 players who can get in on, 2 to 3 pairs who can get in with singles rankings. And then you've on top of that, you've got the 2 wild cards anyway. And then in 32 draws, I would say it's 4 or 5 or 6 pairs maximum who can get in on singles ranking. That way, you're getting plenty of singles players in the draw there. You're getting 12 singles players or 8 singles players, 10 singles players in the draw. Whatever. Now, the other one is Tim Mayotte, who used to be a top 10 player in the world, has replied to me with, I don't know Tim Mayotte very well. He replies to me sometimes on Twitter, but he's come with a bit of a crazy idea to me that the way that they should do it is have a combined ranking and you make everyone play doubles. And I just keep saying to him that the top players will never agree to that. You're not going to get Djokovic to agree to play doubles every single week of the year because it will affect his ranking, or Alcaraz. He seems intent that they would because it's got something on it, but they just wouldn't care about it. They've got something on it now. They just don't have to play doubles. So,
yeah, I'm not sure that's...
He seems quite adamant that that would happen, but it wouldn't. But what concerns me about all this is the talk of, you know, and the ATP keeps saying this. They say this to my players. They occasionally say it to me when I talk to them. Yeah, we need to sort the double situation. And the things that they're looking at is getting more singles players in. And I keep telling them, the singles players will not play. They might play the odd match, but they're not going to play. So you don't have any draw at that stage. And then they're talking about changing the rules, only having one serve to get more rallies and crazy things like this. Just let the doubles play. Stop letting the doubles players getting pushed out of the draws by singles players entering. That's the first port of call. And the last point, sorry, George, I'll come in 1 minute. The last one, the point I forgot to debunk is that I've got a load of people coming in to me going, well, you know, if they want to play in the tournament, they have to get their rankings up. If the rankings were high enough, they'd get in anyway. But that's the point that I'm trying to make. They can't get in, they can't get their ranking up anymore because they can't get into these tournaments. If you, again, as James pointed out, that I said in my tweet, the difference in points between doubles and singles is huge. Imagine how a singles player could get, if a singles player ranks 18 in the world, if they could only play the 4 slams, how quickly would they get to 30 in the world? And that's basically what it is in the doubles. And because of it's even harder in the doubles, because in singles, because the point difference is different, 250s actually have a greater effect. Julian Cash, Rob Galloway won 250 in Delray the other week. It's a massive win for them. They're fantastic to win it. I think Jules went from, he went from something like 59 to 55. I think he's changing that, but that's from winning a 250. I think Henry, I looked at it now, for Henry to get, Henry's I think 68 now, for him to get to top 30, which would get him in the Masters, he'd have to win something. Even if he was in 0 points, even if he had 0 points in his rankings, which he doesn't, he'd have to win something like 8 250s just to get there. Which is just, which is unbelievable that you think, so how are you getting there? So you're basically relying on now, those guys on that ranking are relying on having a real run in a slam. You're basically going to have to make quarters or semis of a slam to give yourself a shot.
George?
Crazy.
Be succinct.
I was actually going to come in on a Tim May. I randomly interviewed him years ago.
I love a random interview, George. It's my favourite sort of... this is my pastime.
Do you want to guess why? That might be a good guessing game. See if you can remember. This is quite niche tennis history.
Did he? Was he like the first person Andy Murray beat on tour or something?
No. He's not that. He's older than that.
He's older than that.
No, it was.
Oh, crikey, he's 63.
It was actually a tennis politics story, James. You'll be pleased to hear.
My fave.
He was wanting to take Justin Gimelstob's spot on the ATP board after he was...
I'm all in favour. I don't even know the guy, but...
Well, so Gimelstob had already gone and he wanted to come in and replace him. And he was someone who was on the ATP council when he was a player, which was, you know, was a while ago. But he didn't get invited to interview. So I think there was quite a lot of question marks at that stage about who had control over how these positions were being filmed. And quite... Anyway, I can send you the link if people are vaguely interested in flashing them in the bathroom. Probably not.
Send me the link, George. I'll put it in the show notes.
It was a few years ago, but I think he came to my attention first on Twitter when I think he claimed that he could get Andy Murray back to world number one. I think it was maybe just after he had his hip replacement. He said it had like something, I forget what it was, but it was some mad claim like that.
Excellent. Right, let's do some quick hits. Without wanting to wind Calvin up again, Queens is going to host a WTA event from 2025 because that's what we need. More tennis events in London, Calvin.
Yeah, more big live tennis. There's not enough of it in London, is there? And I mean, another reason why I think that's crazy, again, because it's another one of my favourite topics, grass courts. So I don't know which one's going to go first, the women's or the men's, but whichever one goes second, those courts are going to be knackered. So we're starting on a tournament that's...
You said, sorry, George, you said the women's is first,
I thought,
or second?
Was it not the women's first? I thought they were okay. Yeah, I think right. It's the same week as Nottingham. They're putting it in.
That's a shame.
Straight after French, I think, yeah.
Yeah, so those courts are going to be knackered. And again, like, what... I don't get what is the value in this, because those other events are well attended. Yeah, but the other events are well
George
attended.
George is making
though,
the money
George.
Sign.
Yeah, but, you know, why not make Nottingham a 500? What's the problem with that? If we wanted to do that.
I mean, I would guess...
I mean, my guess would be the amount you could charge ticket prices and things like that in London.
I think Nottingham probably
like,
doesn't...
Unless that was a thing like Queens make more money.
But I suspect Nottingham doesn't fulfil the requirements for a 500. It's quite a small centre.
Okay. I'd be surprised.
Queens must be one of the... I was going to say, Queens must be one of the very few British events that actually... makes a decent profit, so there's probably just a pure numbers thing here of thinking let's try and do the same a week before with the women.
I mean, I'm interested to see that because Queens is actually very well attended. Queens is well attended, you get a lot of locals there. It'd be interesting to see if they're as keen to go and watch a WTA event as they are to watch an ATP event.
The thing with Queens is, I mean, I don't buy tickets for tennis events, I forget how expensive they are. Some friend of mine got their Queens tickets the other day and they're like £160 for the day or something.
It's much more expensive than Wimbledon.
So, you know, if the pricing is sensible, then it might actually be quite an attractive product for people. It's a massive if, but Jamie Murray is tournament director now and he's reasonably sensible, so I assume he'll have a say. I don't know. We'll see.
Is it rooted as the same level tournament as the men's one? Because, I mean, they'll also get themselves in a right stupor if they start charging less for one than the other, if not. But was it suggested it might be a 250 rather than a 500 women's?
Right, okay.
Am I right? Or is it?
Well, I mean, from what I saw, it was supposed to be a 500.
That is a can of worms that... Yeah, okay. Well, I think...
I've got one more before we all go, which is Andy Murray. Beating David Goffin, losing to Andrei Rublev. All I'm going to say is that's exactly what I expect Andy Murray to do at events like Indian Wells these days, is beat someone who, frankly, isn't playing very well in the first round, then lose to a pretty good player in the second round fairly one-sidedly. Has anyone got anything to add to that?
No, I think not necessarily on that. I think Andy's got a fair point now where he's getting asked again this week about when he's going to retire. And I think, you know, I think he got a bit pissed off in the press conference. I think he's got good reason to as well. Like, what more do you want? He kept saying, I don't know what more I can say. I don't know who these... I assume it's none of the British journalists who are asking it. Like, what more do you want him to say? Like, he's already given all the information he can.
It's that tricky thing, isn't it? Like, you sort of always... You find different ways to ask the question, but Andy's bright enough to know what you're doing. Like, you sort of dress it up a different way or ask him a different element of it. But yeah, like, he's been pretty clear about it now that he's going at some point this summer. That I think, I mean, I've said before, I think probably there'll be a few people lining up with a checkbook to convince him to quit at their tournament. Like Laver Cup, I imagine, would probably quite fancy an Andy Murray retirement party to rival Roger Federer's. Similarly, I'm sure the LTA would love him to retire at Davis Cup group stages in Manchester. Like, but
where is Laver Cup this time?
Berlin,
right?
I mean, yeah, it wouldn't be a classic, but it probably wouldn't matter too much. And I think they wouldn't like balk at paying him $2 million, $3 million to do something stupid. Well, maybe not that much, but
could be Nadal's as well.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, and that would drive up the numbers involved. I think that's all we've got time for because we've already gone on for ages. And that's just Calvin's doubles rant. Which I mean, for people who don't recognise the reference, and now we move on to the liars, it is Father Ted receiving the Golden Cleric, and it's very much worth the watch. We've not mentioned Jodie Burridge, who's having wrist surgery. Commiserations to her. Best of luck with her recovery. And we've not mentioned something that George mentioned on the order of play, which is Felix Auger-Aliassime's shocking form at Masters and Slams events over the last year. I think we will come on to that next week. Hopefully we will have time to do so because it is definitely worth discussing. We might even speak to Jeff Horn about it, who's a friend of the pod and whose tweet you flagged George about it. So I'm not even going to give you a chance for any other business, George. You don't look too gutted about it, so it'll be fine. Thank you very much for listening, as always. If you've made it all the way to the end, well done. You have remarkable stamina. Please do leave us a rating and review if you have, because you've clearly enjoyed it. And most importantly, please do come back next week.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Podcast Network.